Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Tuesday afternoon, so if Donald Trump does something disastrous, you'll have to wait till Thursday to talk about it. How do we begin our show? We begin our show with the voice of a patriot. We begin our show with the voice of an immigrant. We begin our show with someone who was actually featured in a Ken Burns documentary when he was 10 years old. I think it's the one about the Statue of Liberty. And so when you look at Colonel Vindman, and then you hear his testimony during the impeachment hearings of 2019, and you go back and you see him being interviewed by Ken Burns, you think he was destined for this. He was destined to remind us why coming to America was so important and what America and the vision of America at least was and now needs to become again. Now, the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So we like Marsha Brown. We like her a lot. She's smart. She writes really well. And she writes for one of my absolute favorite sort of journalistic outlets, The American Prospect. And The American Prospect has been around for a long time. And the question always was in the very beginning, Marsha, was it going to survive? Well, they were in competition with the conservative version of The American Prospect. That is no longer the case. It doesn't exist anymore. But The American Prospect, it is still here. And it is producing phenomenal information about lots of issues that unfortunately CNN and MSNBC and most of the mainstream media don't pay attention to because there's just so much on our plate. But yet with Donald Trump as president, you better pay attention to a lot of the issues that The American Prospect talks about. And one of them is immigration policy. And that's where Marsha Brown comes in, because you have been focusing a lot on the whole issue of immigration policy. And sadly, Donald Trump has given you a lot to write about. And unfortunately, most of us aren't paying attention to what he's doing, but we must. So you have two stories, but let's go with the original story, because again, when we talk about immigration, we've been talking about legal immigration. We've been talking about undocumented immigrants. We've been talking a lot about that issue. What we haven't really spent a lot of time on is asylum seekers. And what I thought was interesting in your piece, because it was entitled The Public Comment Battle to Save American Asylum. This was written back in July. Apparently the rulemaking is going to become forthcoming in August. Am I correct? The end of August is when we're going to actually know what the official rule is going to be. But at the time that you wrote it, July 15th, you wrote, a new rule would greatly restrict asylum. Advocates are fighting back with public comments. And as I was reading your article, there were a couple things that I thought about. So whenever they do anything about DACA or immigration or, you know, the undocumented, they're going to get 100,000 comments. They're going to get it because they have family here, because they have connections here, because they have a whole group of people that are, you know, out there advocating. The whole point about seeking asylum is you're probably on your own, Jack. There isn't a big community to support you. People may not have those connections with you. So while we want to be a place where people can seek refuge and come as an asylum seeker, when I looked at the number of comments, of which there were, I guess, 40,000, it paled in comparison to what they usually get when you're talking about immigration policy. But that's a comment about who they are and why they need our help probably more than anyone else. So welcome to the program, Marsha Brown. And tell us exactly what Donald Trump, the evil Donald Trump, and his evil twin, Stephen Miller, who I don't know. I think he wakes up in the middle of the night going, ooh, I could do that too. Ooh, I could do that too. It's kind of like, it's like he's sticking pins in immigration policy. That's really what he's doing. Yeah. He thinks it's a voodoo doll and he's sticking pins in it. So talk to me about this whole change in asylum. What is it currently and how is it changing?
Well, absolutely. And I want to thank you for your analogy of the pins, just because the devil's in the details. And I do think that this administration, I mean, there are a lot of ways that legal experts have said that they've been sloppy, and they've certainly lost in court for things that if they had just been, you know, crossed their T's and dotted their I's, they would have been fine on. But on the other hand, they also have really dug deep and figured out ways that they could have a big impact without legislation necessarily. And so exactly. These two rules, I think, are a great example of that. And so I want to back up a little bit just to go back all the way to 1951, which was when the Refugee Convention happened.
Okay, this is absolutely perfect. I want history, because in history will actually make me understand better what we're dealing with today.
Right. And so that was an international convention where after the World Wars, they were trying to figure out how can we help folks who are fleeing a war-torn country. They're fleeing persecution. And so they came up with the definition of a refugee, of an asylum seeker. And the US actually didn't sign on to it until later, but we are part of it now. And basically, under current law, so a refugee is somebody who claims that they are being persecuted outside of the US, and then the US allows them to enter under refugee status. So the US has a refugee cap. In the Obama administration, it was, I think, a little over 100,000 a year. Under Trump, he has slashed it to something like 17,000. I mean, it is really, really small now. And that is the kind of thing that, because of all of the stakeholders in that, people who provide for those refugees, help them resettle, give them a place to live when they arrive here, that will actually won't be able to, should Biden be elected, that won't be something that can just, the switch can be turned and everything will be great. We can just go right back up to 100,000 refugees. Mm-hmm. And then there are asylum seekers. And asylum seekers are people who come to the US, they cross the border, however they cross the border. Maybe they enter through an official port of entry, like an airport, or maybe they cross at the border between the US and Mexico, and they say, I am an asylum seeker. They have an initial fear, a credible fear interview, and most asylum seekers pass that. And then they're basically, depending on how you come in, and this is where it gets complicated, especially under the Trump administration, but you're often allowed to remain in the US until your asylum hearing is litigated, until you have to show up in court.
Okay, so I just need a clarification. So we have a refugee and we have an asylum seeker. Right. They are not the same.
Under US law, for complicated reasons, they're not.
And again, give me the definition of a refugee versus an asylum seeker. We throw these words together and I need to understand, because if they're kind of in a different silo, I need to understand why they're in this silo versus that silo. And it sounds to me like the asylum seeker is probably the highest status. Am I correct?
I don't know that that's necessarily correct. In some countries, refugees and asylum seekers are kind of interchangeable. Okay. But in the US, a refugee is someone who claims that they're being persecuted and asks to come to the US from outside the US, whereas an asylum seeker makes their claim once they're inside US borders. So a refugee, for example, and this is, you know, part of the reason why Trump's cuts are so harmful, actually, even for diplomacy reasons, somebody who maybe was a spy for the US in Iran or Iraq, and they're persecuted and they say, I need to come to the US or I'm going to be killed. They maybe don't qualify because the cap was already met. You know, 17,000 refugees have already been, come to the US this year. And so that has been a real issue. And a lot of advocates have been very worried about that.
Marcia, aren't a lot of the refugees also people who have been designated internationally by the UN High Commissioner on Refugees, mm-hmm. or somebody else? Like, for instance, if you're fleeing Rwanda and the genocide that's going on there, or the Syrian refugees, you know, there's a certain number of people that are designated as refugees, and then the UN will ask, who's going to take these folks?
Right.
The U.S. says before they're even in the country that we will take this number, as opposed to asylum seekers who themselves come to the border and present themselves and right. say, I fear persecution in my home country and I want to be admitted as a refugee in the U.S.
So what I'm hearing from you is one may have sort of a partner, i.e. the U.N., a refugee, but an asylum seeker seems to be more like they're on their own, that they're fleeing, that they're showing up inside the United States seeking asylum, and there isn't, there, they haven't been vetted, no one.
There's no vetting.
Right, exactly. Okay.
That's
okay.
A big difference too.
Yeah, that's okay, because, that's good.
Yeah.
All right. So now talk to me about what Stephen Miller has come up with, because, you know, Stephen Miller, we know he's the Darth Vader of all this. And for whatever reason, Trump, I don't think Trump has a clue to what he's doing, but Stephen Miller loves it because he's writing it all. He's figuring it out. And in the end, it just feels like almost anything that even sort of looks like, smells like, acts like an immigration policy, he is going to sort of undermine.
Yeah, so the administration announced these two new rules that would fundamentally really change the asylum system. And the first one really actually gets to the heart of the definition of asylum and really significantly changes what it means to be persecuted in a way that a lot of people who have been granted asylum and are in the United States and have been for a long time, they wouldn't have won their cases. So, you know, one example is that pretty much now you have to be persecuted by your government. You have to be able to prove that your government persecuted you for your belief, for political opposition, for your identity, and you have to show that the government has attempted that. And a lot of governments are not going to outright say, oh yeah, it's our policy to imprison people who are gay. You know, they're not gonna do that. And so that makes it harder on the one hand. And then on
so
the other
couldn't
hand,
you do this? Couldn't you do this? So I don't know whether the government is threatening me, but they just hung two gay guys. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? So in the sense that, right. that's, I mean, do I have to be hung to prove that the government doesn't like me? Or can I point to the other two gay guys that are hung and saying, I'm gay too? I think they don't want us here. You see what I mean?
According to like one LGBTQ advocate I spoke to on this issue, they basically said that you have to be able to prove that they tried to hurt you. They tried to hang you. Like, it's not just that like it happened to somebody else or something like that. And then, I mean, the other thing I would point out, and I think this actually is really an issue, is that it has to be a state actor now. So it used to be that like, if you could prove I'm persecuted by a gang or I'm persecuted by a non-state actor, they've tried to kill my family, they've killed a member of my family, that is a good reason for you to, you know, seek asylum. Now that doesn't qualify. That doesn't make you eligible for asylum anymore, which severely cuts down who can claim asylum. So, you know, one, especially in the LGBTQ issue, that's a really tough one because, you know, as much as the U.S. is many things, it still is one of the few places in the world that is relatively safer for queer folks. Mm-hmm. And this makes it much harder for someone who is trans to claim asylum here.
God. All right. So now that I'm depressed about that, so what else has he done in sort of making changes on the asylum? Because again, I mean, he's creating a standard that you have to, it's like threading a needle by the time you get done. And the hole of the needle is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I need glasses anyway to thread my needle. So I just can't even imagine what you're doing. But my understanding is he's also creating longer delays, as well as an inability to actually work while you're being delayed. So if you're coming over as a refugee or an asylum seeker, you're probably spent a lot of money to get here, but how long can you stay here with no income? And what is he doing that way?
Before you get to the delays, can I just say that having it have to be a government that is persecuting you, that means that domestic violence victims, for instance.
Also, yes.
People who've been raped, anything like that, you know, you can't flee because of the domestic violence and abuse you've been suffering.
Unless you can prove it's a prince or a sheikh. No, I'm sorry. I want people to understand how absurd this is. This is just, I mean, we are at the point of absurdity. So now we see these issues. So now talk to us a little bit about the other things they're doing. So even if you get here, you may not be able to stay here because of what kind of constraints they're putting on you.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of really threading the needle, the rule that I just talked about is 161 pages. So it's not like it's just a small change. I mean, it's really rewriting what asylum is. And this next rule that I'm going to talk about is 97 pages. So it, you know, similarly is something where it's getting into the nitty gritty and changing the details such that it really changes people's lives. And so what this rule does is, so under current law, let's say you come to the US and you file for asylum. Maybe you came in on a tourist visa and decide to apply for asylum, but you apply for asylum. And under those rules, you have to wait 150 days between the day that you filed your asylum application and the day that you can file a work permit, a file for a work permit known as an EAD. Okay. So other immigrants, when they get like DACA or some other kind of immigration document, the sort of work permit aspect of it is kind of attached, but not with asylum. It's they're not really dependent on each other. So, so you apply, you wait 150 days, you apply for your asylum, for your work permit, excuse me. And then USCIS, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, they have to process that work permit application within 30 days.
So this is an automatic. So this is like, it's a standard 150 days, they get it, and then they have to somehow give you the work permit within 30 days. Okay, they're changing that.
And so under this new rule, you have to wait 365 days to even apply for a work permit. And then there is no processing deadline. So there's no, like, USCIS has to process it within 30 days. So hypothetically, they could indefinitely be processing your application.
Just like Donald Trump's tax returns.
Exactly.
Oh, Jesus.
An indefinite audit.
Deadline. No. So if there's no deadline, then how do you appeal it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that there is some litigation and there will be a hearing this Friday, actually, about the second rule. And the challengers are saying that this rule is because of the piecemeal approach to the way they're trying to rewrite asylum, it violates administrative procedure law, which is even more technical than like other ways that asylum and immigrant advocates have sued, saying that the administration has violated administrative law. I mean, this is basically saying that even though the administration, you know, went through public notice and comment, they allowed 30 days for the public to comment, and look at what the rule says and what the possibilities are, but they still didn't follow administrative procedure law because they did this piecemeal approach, which makes it much harder for someone to really figure out how the rules are going to mesh together, how they'll change the asylum law, and therefore violates what's known as the APA.
Okay, so let's throw in another wrinkle. Let's throw in the fact that we're in a pandemic. And the pandemic is not just in the United States. It's not just in, it's everywhere. So if you are seeking asylum, you are probably coming from a country that may also have COVID-19. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how he's using the pandemic as another way to sort of weaponize his anti-immigration policy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think ProPublica just came out with a story yesterday or today where they basically said that they reported that children, even if they tested negative, were being deported. So child asylum seekers, even if they tested negative for COVID-19, they were then viewed as COVID, you know, risks and deported.
But Donald Trump tells me that children don't get COVID. Donald Trump tells me you can go back to the school because, I mean, they're practically immune them because if my children are immune, then asylum children should be immune. Donald Trump told me, maybe it's his science, but why aren't they using that? That's just, oh, that's just unbelievable.
I know.
I'm sorry. I'm so shocked. I am still shocked. I have to say this. I know there should be an expectation that he will do these horrific things. So they are now saying that even though they test negative, they still could be sent back because their country of origin has, is there a certain threshold of COVID, or is it, if you only have one COVID case in the entire country, you still could be sent back? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out really how arbitrary and capricious this is. You don't know.
Okay. I mean, it is true that the U.S., especially early in the early months of the pandemic, were deporting COVID positive immigrants back to their countries of origin. And so that happened in Guatemala. I think that might've happened in El Salvador, it is true that the U.S. was basically just like, because the U.S. was so much worse than any other country and was sort of inflicting the pandemic on others by, you know, like doing these immigration policies. So
in a lot of ways, you could be COVID positive, but the COVID positive came because of where you were being warehoused in the United States. And therefore, the United States gave you the COVID, but you're maybe carrying the COVID, so you need to go back. But now it doesn't matter whether you actually are carrying COVID or not, you still have to go back. So what's the point of the test?
Yeah, well, I think it's also really important to keep in mind that the administration has really used the pandemic to shut down both legal immigration and undocumented immigration. But deportations are ongoing. I mean, people are still being deported. And so that part of the immigration system is ongoing. But the parts that, you know, other people would say are very, very important are really struggling. So USCIS, the agency I talked about earlier, is having real financial troubles. And next month, if nothing changes, 70% of its employees will be furloughed, which means that all of these asylum applications I've talked about, they won't be processed. DACA applications won't be processed. Not that the government is saying they're even accepting new DACA applicants, which is still in defiance of the Supreme Court, as far as I can tell. But so there's just lots of ways that the immigration.
So they're doing to immigration what they're doing to USPS. So
that
if you see, right. So if you're beginning to see what's happening with the Postal Service, you know, that they're letting people go, they're telling them they can't do overtime, they're telling all these kinds of things. And literally what it's doing is it's draining the vitality and the ability of the U.S. Postal Service to actually operate. You are seeing the same thing happen because if 70% of those workers are going to be furloughed, what's an agency for if it doesn't have personnel?
Right.
Oh my God. So last but not least, you did write a very powerful piece about the Uyghurs. Mm-hmm. And if there's any group that we clearly know the government is actually, you know, I mean, they have to seek asylum. The government is causing their pain. We've seen what they've been doing in those camps. We know how they're rounding them up. The story you wrote about this Uyghur couple is just so horrific because they came a while ago. But will these new rules apply to them even though they came, you know, months ago?
Yeah, that's a great point and something I should have mentioned earlier, which is there's sort of a snag in this. So the rules are set to take effect August 25th,
right.
You know, pending this litigation, which is they're hoping for a temporary injunction, which would stop the rules going into place. But basically and this is the case for this Uyghur couple that I wrote about, if you haven't reached 150 days from when you filed your asylum application, when August 25th rolls by, you are then subject to this new rule. So this couple will have to wait an additional 238 days for them to apply for a work permit. And for this couple, they're professionals. They were working in Europe. And they saved enough money that they said, okay, if we arrive at this point, we can pay this much in rent and for like, you know, a roof over our heads and something to eat for this amount of time, which is the amount of time, you know, we have until we would be able to apply for our work permit. They got here in February and the rules were announced in June. And so all of a sudden, all their plans are turned upside down. And they really, I mean, there is a pretty big Uyghur community in Virginia, but I mean, there aren't really the kind of support structures that
we're in the middle of a pandemic. They're not. They get unemployed too.
How do you get a job? Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I'm listening to all this, and I just want to cry. I just want to cry. But I wanted everyone to realize that still we're looking at going back to school. We're looking at whether you should wear a mask. We're looking at a guy who denies science. We're looking at what's happening with unemployment. And I mean, and these are the other stories that are happening at the same time. I mean, this is the venality, that he's venal, that this president is, because so much is happening that you don't even know about. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not only destructive to the soul of this country, it's what we stood for. We know that the foreign leaders just ignore us now. I get that. We know he doesn't accept anything in the way of blame. But now look what he's undoing, undermining people, especially, and again, I want to remind everyone, we begin the show with Colonel Vindman. And what was that show about? The show that he was in initially was Ken Burns' piece about the Statue of Liberty when he was 10 years old. Look where we started with the Statue of Liberty and Vindman, and look where we're ending this half hour with you, Marcia, telling us this horrific story that nobody is focusing on because there's so much on our plate, but these are people's lives.
The other story in ProPublica, by the way, was about this woman who was allowed to deliver her baby, and then once the baby had been delivered, they took both the mother and the baby, put them in a hotel, and deported them when the woman had said that her rapist in Guatemala, who is why she fled, her rapist had told her that she would disappear if he saw her again.
But we were just going back to the domestic violence stuff that you were just talking about, Marcia, you know, whether it's the trans stuff or the domestic violence stuff or the gay stuff, now, because they're narrowing the standard, mm-hmm. And now it's just almost anything is acceptable. I just want to end with one last line, and that is at the end of your piece, because it really does, I think, cover it in a nutshell, because you talk to a lot of people within the immigration community and a lot of the advocates. What he said was, okay, to the Trump administration and what it represents, or listen to this, everyone, to the Trump administration and what it represents, there are no good immigrants. Let me repeat that sentence. There are no good immigrants, Kagan says. No one should think that they are exempt. Anyone who comes from another country, no matter what kind of paper you carry, whether you have a criminal record or not, whether you have a college degree or not, you are targeted. The pandemic has allowed Trump policy advisor Stephen Miller to enact his wildest dreams. What remains to be seen is if any of this will be permanent. It's a powerful, powerful way to end your piece. I'm so glad you're focusing on this, Marcia Brown. I'm so glad you're working with the American Prospect. I know you'll be joining us again. So stay healthy, okay?
You too. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. When Europeans first arrived in North America, Atlantic puffins were common on islands in the Gulf of Maine. But hunters killed many of the birds for food or for feathers to adorn ladies' hats. By the 1800s, the population in Maine had plummeted.
Puffins were almost completely lost.
That's Don Lyons of the Audubon Seabird Institute. He says that about 50 years ago, conservationists started bringing puffin chicks from Canada and hand-raising them on the Maine islands. When those birds reached adulthood, they came back to the islands where they were raised and began nesting themselves. Now, the puffin colony in Maine has recovered to more than 1,000 nesting pairs, but global warming threatens to undo some of that progress.
The Gulf of Maine is actually now one of the most rapidly warming water bodies on the planet.
That's driving many fish to cooler waters. So the puffins are forced to fly farther or dive deeper to catch enough food.
The most intense warm years during the last decade have made it very difficult for puffins to raise chicks because of the additional work involved in finding food for them.
So reducing global warming can help Maine's beloved puffins survive. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Everybody to listen. I want to talk about the rich and the super rich, the poor and the super poor. Come on, come on, come on, come on, let's talk about it, talk about it, talk about it, talk about it.
You say
about it.
Thank you. Charlie, don't wait, listen. They make money from the people who live in the ghetto. Yeah. Yes, they do. You see them, you see them, you see them.
And every time you see them, they're styling, profiling, always trying to get more than they give.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I think I really like Ron Knopf. One, because he writes incredibly well. He does amazing research for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You have me now focusing on monopolies in a way that I am so grateful for. And I've decided that I have this dream, Ron Knox. And here's my dream. I want David Dayan. I want Zephyr Teachout. I want Ron Knox. And I'm trying to think of who the other, and I want Matt Stoller.
Yeah.
And I want the four of you on a panel for C-SPAN. And I want you on for 2 hours. And I just want you to talk. Because I think part of the problem is what you write about, the stories that you share, the stories about Amazon, a little bit about what we saw during those that committee hearing with the four big tech CEOs. But we don't know enough about it. We may be slightly outraged, but we don't know how to be white heat outraged. And that's why I'm so grateful. And I see the four of you really focusing on this issue in such a way. And you speak in a vernacular that people understand. And you then have people connect the dots. And so I just need to let you know, I'm really grateful. And if you can make that dream happen, I'll be a real happy camper.
I would. I think that's a great idea. And I'm just, you know, I'm lucky here in the anti-monopoly movement to have such wonderful colleagues as the three people that you named. And I am so happy to be back on your show. And I'm happy that you're interested in this because, of course, from my perspective, monopoly is the weight that's holding this country down. So I'm excited to talk more about it.
And let me just say something else. There's a whole new group of progressives that will probably win in the House of Representatives. And you tweeted it out, and then I saw the tweet. And it was the new, he will be elected. It's a very safe Democratic district, Bowman, the principal from New York. Mm-hmm. And he had a copy of Zephyr Teachout's book, Break Him Up. Okay, he had it in his hands. And he says, this is one of the reasons I am going to Washington. I am going to take this book. I learned from this. I am going to break them up. Now, understand, he's a school principal. So his area of expertise, we think, is education policy and all that stuff. And he's going down to sort of fix the education system. But the book he's holding is Zephyr's book. And I was just over the moon because I want to remind everyone, Ron, and you know this too. In a legislature or in Congress, you don't need a majority. You don't even need half the delegation or, you know, if there's like, say there's 200 members, you don't even need 100. You just need 25 people or 20 people who know something, who care about something, who really want to focus on something. And that small number of people can not only educate the body, but they can ultimately affect change. And that's why when I saw that picture of Bowman holding up Zephyr's book, I was over the moon because I was so happy because I know they're not going to be able to run away from this issue, Ron Knox.
It's all about driving the conversation. And that is what, look, you know, you have Zephyr's book, You have David's new book, right. Nat Stoller's book that came out maybe at the beginning of the year or something. And all of these books, we're building this new body of literature that's going to really tell the story of how monopoly power really manifested in America over the last, 40 years. And even beyond that, right? I mean, the anti-monopoly story in America, it's the story of American history. The Boston Tea Party was literally a rebellion against monopoly. This is the founding, the literal founding threads of our country is the anti-monopoly tradition. And the fact that, it's gaining some traction and it's gaining a new head of steam right now is amazing. And it's exactly like you said, there are people in Congress now, led, I think, by Congressman Cicilline from Rhode Island, who's been a terrific champion of this and has been a driving force, behind the House antitrust subcommittee investigation that led to the hearing that we saw a couple of weeks ago. So there is this new kind of force in Congress, and it's moving and it's shaping the conversation.
Go on, Ken.
I heard Elizabeth Warren talking about it a couple of times when she was running for president.
Elizabeth Warren, Bernie, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar. Klobuchar, of course, is on the Senate antitrust subcommittee. So there was a lot of talk about it starting really in 2016, but certainly this presidential cycle, this campaign cycle, a lot of really good talk about the threats of monopoly and the power of antitrust to stop it.
So I reached out to Ron because they did a big deep dive on Amazon, and we need to get into that big deep dive because it reveals so much. But as I was getting ready to interview you, I do my typical walk through the New Yorker, New York Magazine. I get to the Atlantic Magazine and I'm like, well, hot damn. Why? Because here's the title. Amazon is a private government. Congress needs to step up. Reigning in the tech giants will help restore American democracy. And Stacy Mitchell wrote this. And who is she? She is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And I'm like, oh my God, I got a sandwich. This is like totally perfect. And I posted that piece on my Facebook page. It's getting lots of really interesting comments. But the idea that it's becoming a private government is something I totally relate to. And I think people need to understand what that means. And I'm just going to give you a tiny example. I lived in a little tiny town called Orford, New Hampshire. The town had maybe 1,100, 1,200 people. We had one stop sign, it's ridiculous. But there was a very powerful governor who lived in that town. And he owned the only business in town. He also probably owned all the rental in that town. And he owned about 70% of the land in that community. So guess what? We never had zoning laws. We didn't really even have a planning board. We didn't need one. He was the zoning king. He was the planning king. He would literally give people that would work at his place of business, he would give them a raise, and then he would raise their rent. So whatever raise they got, he would suck away in rent. So as I am reading your article about Amazon, and I'm thinking about this private government, I'm going, oh, honey bun, I've been there, I've seen that. It was on a small scale, but what makes Amazon so frightening is that it is a private government that's competing with the United States. It's competing with the EU. This is a real challenge for all of us. So before we get into your deep dive about Amazon, tell us a little bit about what is in the Atlantic Monthly article, because what I love about how it was framed with these tech giants is Jeff Bezos has never appeared before Congress.
Isn't that wild?
This was a virgin event.
Yeah, isn't that wild? So what Stacey was really writing about in the Atlantic was about how Jeff Bezos and Amazon are the zoning king of the entire, online commerce industry and beyond just that, right? That's just, a part of it. But I think it's very hard for your average person to understand the wild amounts of power that Amazon wields over commerce in America today. It's very hard to understand. It becomes easier to understand if you are a seller on the platform. So if you're a seller on Amazon, and you have a problem, which a lot of sellers do. If suddenly your stock goes missing from the Amazon warehouse, if suddenly you get flagged because Amazon thinks you're a counterfeiter and you're making counterfeit products and selling them, you have any of these problems, who do you turn to? In the actual world of commerce, you would think, okay, well, I can turn to there's a regulatory body I can turn to. There's some kind of democratically powered, official group or body or person that I can turn to for help. In the world of Amazon, you have to turn to Amazon. Amazon is the only governing body that can help you. And whether and whatever it chooses is the word. There is no other choice. There's no appeals board. There's nothing. Right.
So there were three words. Let me just write something. There were three words that she uses in this article that I just want people to understand. So this is the private government, the only place you can turn to. But then she uses three words: spying, stealing, and bullying. So whenever you think of Amazon, everyone, I want you to have those three words in front of you: spying, stealing, and bullying. That's very sophisticated, but it kind of explains a little bit about what you just described. The problem is the person that's spying, stealing, and bullying is the one that you have to go to when you have a complaint. And they have to make the decision because they are everything. They're not only the spire, they're the decider.
And it's the small businesses of America that are the victims of those three things, of the spying, the stealing, and the bullying. It's supposed to be the fabric of America, right? This is like what Main Street America is supposed to be made of, our small businesses, our entrepreneurs, yet they're all controlled, vastly controlled by Amazon, by this one monopolist that has an absolute stranglehold over so much of the economy of America today. So that's the issue. So what Stacey was writing about is how, okay, so that's, you know, all those things are true about Amazon. So we got a glimpse, we got a window into the possible, what's possible through this congressional hearing that happened a couple of weeks ago. And you saw these lawmakers, well-informed, sharp, organized, coordinated.
Cicilline, I love you. Oh my God, from Rhode Island, I'm having a heartthrob. He was incredible. He was incredible. I keep going.
You know, and Jayapal and you know, and a lot of other folks, and even some folks, you know, on the Republican side had really, really important, really pointed questions to ask of all the tech CEOs, but in particular, Jeff Bezos. And you got this glimpse of what real democracy can look like and what real accountability can look like, which, you know, what Stacey's arguing in her piece and that I think is really correct is that there's an entire generation of Americans who don't really believe the government can work like that, right? Exactly. I mean, I'm not so old. I've never seen anything like that display of real oversight and real governance on Capitol Hill. It was remarkable. And, you know, and the argument is clear that there has to be more of that if we're really going to maintain the democracy. There has to be.
And there was, but what was interesting there was that it was also bipartisan. I mean, there was like a Tea Party guy that was actually going after Jeff Bezos. I mean, I thought that was, and in part, I'm always a little bit worried about bipartisan because Donald Trump still hates Jeff Bezos. That is this really bipartisan, or is this still kind of an extension of Trump because Trump has given them cover to sort of attack Jeff Bezos? Although I'm kind of glad that they're attacking him on this issue because this is an issue where I think he is potentially vulnerable if Congress actually steps up and actually starts doing its job, which is clear. And at the end of Stacey's article, and then I want to get into your piece about Amazon, give me some ideas of what we can do with the Amazons of this world. I mean, I worry about this because as you point out, and I'm very familiar with this, Amazon has more lobbyists in Washington than there are US senators. Yeah. One company, not big pharma, and all the pharmaceutical companies, they usually have three for every senator, but one company has more lobbyists than there are US senators. I mean, that means they're assigned the task. Okay, you get this one, you take them to lunch, you do this. I mean, it's gross.
And this is the problem, right? I mean, Amazon is just being nice. They could afford 10 times that many lobbyists.
Yes.
You know, Jeff Bezos himself could employ an entire army of lobbyists, you know, to take over Capitol Hill. So, you know, to jump to the punchline a little bit, what can be done about Amazon? We would like to see two things done. And the first is really primary. And the first is really important. And that's break the company up. We don't think a company that has a monopoly in one industry, and Amazon absolutely has a monopoly in online commerce. We do not think they should be able to tie that monopoly power to other ancillary industries that are part of its kind of octopus arms of a corporation, right? Its logistics, you know, industry, its whole shipping and warehousing business, Amazon Web Services, which is its cloud computing business, its you know, digital advertising business, which is now the third largest digital advertiser in the world after Google and Facebook. It's taking the power of its core monopoly and spreading that power to other parts of the company. That's wrong. That's literally against the spirit and the letter of the antitrust laws. So we think that's the first thing. And then there's a whole suite of, you know, regulatory actions that we think, you know, that Congress can take, that enforcement agencies can take. There are some changes to the antitrust laws that would make these things easier to happen. That is really the charge of Congress. So,
I remember when I was in high school, we were studying monopolies and trust, and there was a simple concept called tie-ins. I mean, that's what this is all about.
That's what this is all about.
They got more knots and ties and French knots and everything else. And it's just, it's so obvious to me, Ron. This is not a heavy lift for Congress. Well, everything you write in your report about Amazon, which I posted it, everyone, go to the report. Even on my personal Facebook page, not only did I put the Atlantic article, I put your report. I gave sort of the nuggets of information that you pulled in. Every single one of them is disgusting. And it's obvious. And it's not a heavy lift to say this is a violation of the law. How are they getting away with it and getting away with it for so long? And on top of that, during a I mentioned the other day that Jeff Bezos in one day, everyone, in one day made $13 billion in one day. And you know what my recommendation to him was? That he should give that $13 billion to the United States Postal Service, because even though he's, you know, going to be bigger than FedEx and bigger than USPS, he still needs the Postal Service because he doesn't want to go into rural areas, because guess what? It's not profitable.
Yeah, exactly. There are two core things, right? I mean, I think there are two core pieces of this that are really, you know, fundamental to our antitrust laws. There are things that Amazon are doing and they're not getting in trouble for, and we think that should change, right? One is the tying, exactly like you said. Amazon tying its core monopoly in online commerce, in e-retail, to all of its other businesses, that, you know, it essentially forces small businesses that want to sell on its platform to buy into all these other things. It forces these companies to buy into its fulfillment system, to buy into its advertising, right? If you don't buy those things, if you don't pay to play, you know, good luck. No one's ever going to find your product to buy it, right? So that's one thing that Amazon is doing that we think is a really clear violation of the antitrust laws. And the other is predatory pricing. Look, Jeff Bezos had to sit before this congressional hearing, which of course he had never done before, and I don't think was very, you know, really prepared for, like spiritually prepared for, to answer these questions about his core business. And he basically admitted that they price things below cost in order to, you know, expand their power in some markets. So the Amazon Echo, which is very popular, he said, well, sometimes it's on sale, so that would be below cost. Oh, and also it's always on sale. So yeah, it's below cost, right? So this is called predatory pricing. It is a core part of antitrust jurisprudence in America. And we think Amazon is violating that part of the antitrust laws all the time. The trick is that I think there has to be some legislative changes to make it easier to prosecute those things. So that's really what we're asking for. That's really what we're hoping the result of this congressional investigation and this report.
So I want to go into more detail about Amazon, but I do let you know that you may have heard my phone ring before. And the reason my phone is ringing and my phone is literally buzzing is that Kamala Harris has just been chosen by Joe Biden as his VP.
I saw that.
So, no. So I want you at some point, if you don't know already, so she was an attorney general in California. A lot of state attorney generals are now stepping into the fray where they're not seeing Congress act because Congress feels in some ways like it's castrated, although we were excited by that hearing, but one hearing is not enough for me. But attorney generals are now beginning to sort of step up. Did Kamala ever deal with issues of trust and monopoly when she was attorney general? And if you don't know the answer to that, I hope you start doing the homework on that, because I want her to be asked those questions. Because given the hearing that we just saw, given that piece in the Atlantic Monthly, given what you've discussed about Amazon, I would love to see her talk about that, because that's one of the issues I think that needs to be addressed. And that could be her area of expertise. You know, she could be our go-to person when it comes to that issue, but I don't know what her history is as a former attorney general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think she needs to really speak to that. She needs to take up this fight. I think it's so crucial. And I think that she is, as a former attorney general, I think she's in a great position to do it. Her record on antitrust, as far as I know, I've seen that she did some of the things that a lot of state attorneys general do as part of their antitrust work, which is essentially follow on to federal cases, a lot of price fixing, stuff like that. I don't know that she's ever taken on a really big, you know, merger challenge, for example, or a monopoly case, for example. I don't know that she has ever done that. But you know, we're holding out hope. We hope that it's going to be a good administration. I saw today that Joe Biden is having a fundraiser discussion with Congressman Cicilline and Senator Klobuchar around antitrust issues. So so that is, a big step. At least the conversation is starting.
Well, and the other reason I even mentioned, I wanted to mention Kamala while I was talking to you, is that usually, you know, usually you're assigned almost a task. And there are so many tasks for Joe Biden, it'll make your head spin. But given the fact that she has been an attorney general, given the fact that she does get this idea of, you know, the concept of monopoly and antitrust, and it has such cachet with small business, because this isn't about big business. This is about eating, spitting up, and destroying small business. And if you are going to restore this economy, then one of the ways you restore the economy is you make sure that small business can thrive and survive. And guess what? You got to bust up Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, I'll go a step further than that. I mean, it's not just about, you know, small businesses and consumers, which it is certainly about that. It's about workers. It's about literal everyday workers in America who have seen their wages suppressed, wage stagnation or wages falling for a generation or more in America, who have fewer and fewer jobs to choose from because of all of this industry consolidation, right? I mean, this is an issue that touches everybody and it touches everything in the economy of America and in American life. I just think it's so extremely crucial for it to become, a point of contention on the campaign trail, not just for, you know, for the Democratic ticket, but I think this question should really be put to Trump and to his administration. What have you done, you know, to fight corporate concentration? You know, that's Trump on the campaign trail in 2015, 2016, He talked a little bit about antitrust, right? I mean, he had some messaging around that. And then we've seen an extraordinarily inactive Justice Department, literally, you know, waste people's time doing, investigating cannabis industry mergers that they had no business looking at, right?
Exactly. So the underbelly, like anyone cares, you know, that's the easy fruit to pick up, as if people are even focusing on that. But of course, yeah. I mean, Donald Trump knows the words. He doesn't believe in the policy because he doesn't believe in governing. You know, and the reason why the Atlantic Monthly story really struck me when she talked about the fact that you know, Amazon is a private government and these tech companies are private governments, is that the more you see dysfunction within the federal government, the more you see their inability to act, you then become even more dependent on business to take care of you. I mean, I kind of look at what happened in Texas when they wanted to have the bathroom bill. You know, like, what the hell was that about? It took the business community to shut down the Republicans on the bathroom bill. I mean, they couldn't even get the votes until the business community said, would you kill this bill? I mean, but in a way, I feel like they're like benevolent despots. You know, they're rich, they're controlling. And now because my government that I elect is dysfunctioning, I need them to protect first. And you just get to be a subset of that. So before I let you go, Ron, give me four nuggets about Amazon that people need to understand so that as we talk about monopolies, they will understand why this is both personal for them, bad for business, bad for their future, and bad for workers.
Okay. So the first nugget is about its power. And I think that people don't really understand it. So the one nugget that I'll throw out there is that for the majority of products sold in America, Amazon controls more than 70% of all the sales that happen online. 70%. You can't argue with that. That's monopoly power flat out. So that's the first thing. If you're a small business, the second thing, if you're a small business and you're selling on Amazon, an average of 30% of every dollar that you take in goes to Amazon. And that's low. That's not even as high as it gets. That's just the average. One out of every $3 that you take in goes into Amazon's pocket just because it has the power to do it. The third thing I'll say about Amazon is that it has it champions itself. It says we are small businesses' friend, but the vast majority of small businesses that sell on Amazon are out of business by year number three because they can't make a profit with Amazon's fees. They can't make their margins with Amazon taking, you know, the fees out of the cut of every sale. In this report that we put out, we profiled the company. I won't go into the details, but it was a hair care products company. By the end, by 2018, when they were really struggling, Amazon was taking 46% of every single sale in fees for various things.
Okay, so we have to let you go. I want you to talk 2 hours. But the thing is that as I'm looking at the pandemic, so we know that the amount of online sales has been going up and up and up. Well, the pandemic has now made everyone an online purchaser because, you know, you don't want to go out by yourself. You don't want to do something. So this is the way that you keep, this is kind of like vote by mail because you don't want to vote in person. Well, now you shop by online because you don't want to go to the store. And we knew it was changing anyway, but now the grotesqueness is, it is like falling into Amazon's lap. Because if it was 70%, it'll probably, you're talking about 70% of a finite number, but that number keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. That's so right. It's now 70% of a watermelon as opposed to like maybe a cantaloupe. So that's I want right. people to understand what this means. So his power is increasing like crazy. And that's where I think it's really imperative that if we make change in 2020, we must deal with this issue because then ultimately Amazon won't be a private government. Amazon will have eaten the world.
Yes. And my last note, look, as those sales go up and up and Amazon takes over more and more of commerce, the cut of the revenue of small businesses that Amazon takes goes up and up as well. Amazon puts small businesses out of business. They're not small businesses' friend. That's what I'll say.
I want to sit down with Jeff Bezos someday. Ha, 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 ha. And in a way, you're destroying what you created because you need small business to be created. You need these things to happen. And if it becomes so obvious that there's no point in even starting because you're eating their lunch, then what you ultimately created, you ultimately destroy. And this is where, I love the story about the Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, good rules make good neighbors. Not just good fences, but good rules make good neighbors. Mm. And if you play by the rules, not only do you thrive, but you survive. And Amazon, because it thinks it's this Pac-Man of online everything, will ultimately eat itself. The level of selfishness and stupidity sometimes blows my mind. But Ron Knox, that's why I want this meeting with you and Zephyr, Matt Stoller, and David Dayan. Because I think if people got to hear this, they would be apoplectic and they would demand change. Because in the end, it's essential for our economy. Thank you so much for writing. For the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie. Thank you, Ken. Keep going. Keep on the Monopoly trail.
I promise. Yeah. All right, everyone. Okay. It's Kamala Harris. She's our new VP choice by Joe Biden, like we couldn't tell. Anyway, we'll schmooze tomorrow, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
One morning I woke up and I knew a new day.